lot of you will have input, and feel free to be open about your input. And we don't need the world hearing everything that you have to say. Sangha is supposed to be sacred, a sacred space, so that's the way it's going to be. Also this afternoon, I'm going to talk a little bit about the study of self-identity and psychedelics, a book that I just finished, which is fascinating. So, it's going to be provocative, to say the least. So, and don't forget, there the questionnaires in the back that I want you to fill out at lunchtime. I printed out 30, and I think maybe about 30 people are here, and maybe a little more. If there's more, copy it, and I've got blank paper that you can use. Sorry. So about 3 weeks ago, I gave a talk on the first step of entering the stream. And entering the stream means actually waking up. Some people use the word enlightenment. Other people use the word nibbana or nirvana. And in Buddhist spirituality, there are definitive steps that need to be taken. I don't think anything is as clear-cut as that, but I think it's a very useful map or path to follow. And when you start firmly on the path, you become a stream enterer, a sotapanna in Pali. Now, a lot of teachers don't talk about this. And why do you think that is? And by the way, we are in noble silence, and it will be silent except when I say, so what do you think? Or want some response. Then you can say whatever you want. So why do you think that it's this stepping stone towards enlightenment? It's talked around, but it's not mentioned specifically often. Why do you think that is? Nobody has a clue. Okay, yes. Exactly. That's exactly it. You have then established another goal. And having a goal in this practice is going to get you not too far. It's constantly letting go that is going to help you get on this path. So, and how subtle is that? You know, we want to wake up, but we don't want the goal of waking up. It's very difficult. This is why we have a meditation practice, because in that space, you can start seeing the goalless path, for lack of a better way to put it. And it's very difficult to talk about. So I'm taking a chance here talking about this, but this is a guide. It's not to be a goal. I have found that the 10 fetters, which is the 10 asavas, which the Buddha talked about as the markers along the path, to be very helpful in my own practice. They're practical. I don't look at them as goals, but I look at them as practical steps to look at how I am working with this practice. And the reason I wanted to bring up self-identity, it is the very first one. To me, it is also the beginning and the end of the path, because way up at number 7 is conceit. So the first one that we are to look at to begin to uproot is self-identity. 7th one is conceit. And by the way, it's the 8th one, I'm sorry, because the 9th one is restlessness, and the 10th one is ignorance. So, briefly, I'll give you the list, although we're not going to work with this list today, but in this tradition we have so many. So Along the path, the very first thing we start to uproot is self-identity. Okay, the second is doubt, which is what I'm going to be speaking about next Thursday night. The third is reliance on rites and rituals. The fourth is starting to uproot sensual desire, meaning the senses just pull you in constantly. I just read a thing in the New York Times this morning about a guy who finally unplugged his phone. It's a great article, by the way. Look at the Times today. And the fifth is aversion. These five get you to a point with the goalless goal, the goalless path, way up there. You're almost enlightened if you can do this. The sixth is not clinging to existence, and the seventh is not clinging to non-existence. You can see where the non-attachment's coming in. You're really just floating and being okay with anything. The eighth, as I mentioned, is conceit. The ninth is, what did I say it was? Oh God, now I'm forgetting. Doubt. That's it, restlessness. Thank you very much. And the tenth is ignorance. So we're going to talk about self-identity today. And you think of setting up self-identity as conditions for waking up, not I'm going to get rid of my self-identity. That's impossible. We need a self-identity to walk around with. But we can set up the conditions where we are not so attached to it. That's what this practice is all about. And actually, the entire Noble Eightfold Path is set up that way. You read the Eightfold Path, which we go over in every different possible way. It's all about releasing this attachment to self-identity, to ego, which is the cause of our suffering. You know, there's an analogy here, and one I just read was about pain. So some people have, you know, debilitating pain, and perhaps they had an operation on their leg, and their leg is really, really suffering. Another person has the exact same pain and doesn't suffer, but his pain comes from working out. He just had a really good workout session and he's got pain in his upper thigh because the muscles are so sore. Exact same kind of pain, one suffers and one doesn't. It's the identity that was created that caused the suffering, not the pain. This is from the Dalai Lama. I know nothing that brings greater happiness than a tamed mind. I know of nothing that brings greater unhappiness than an untamed mind. That's our practice. This is what we're trying to do. And self-identity is the nucleus of the self. As you know, most of you know who have been coming to practice and practicing, know the Buddha talked about three traits of existence. And many of you who I know well know these quite well. And the first one is anicca, which is everything is impermanent. There is nothing that is permanent. Nothing. Nada. It's not going to happen. The second is there is suffering in life, dukkha. Not life is suffering. There is suffering in life. And even if you're having the happiest life imaginable, eventually you're going to get sick and eventually you will die. That's also impermanence. And then anatta is there is no permanent abiding self. And we're starting to work with that, with this self-identity, when I call it the nucleus of self. It is a way of looking at the self that is not permanent, and we'll go into that in just a little bit. Ananta is not saying there is no self. What it's saying is the definition of a self is an ongoing process, continually changing. You can give yourself the example, are you the same as you were when you were 14? Do you think the same? Is your body the same? Are your memories the same? Are what you like to do the same? No. And biologically, I believe it's every 7 years all of our cells are recreated. So if that's what's happening, what is this self we're clinging on to? Where is that? In Buddhist spirituality, what makes up the self, and I'm not going to do a long talk about this because we've all heard it, well, some of us have heard it many times, it's called the khandhas or the skandhas in Sanskrit. And the Buddha said, all of us is made up of these five things. And that's all there is. The body, okay, everything in the body. And then perceptions, how we think about things. Feeling comes right after body, because body and feeling then goes into perception. And then perception goes into volition, sometimes called karma. And all of this is played out in consciousness. Now this is all heavy stuff, and like I said, I'm not going to go into it. And I've, you know, learned it for a long time, and it's frankly a lot of words, and I think for most of us it's a lot of words, but it doesn't actually feel experiential. And this whole practice is about experiential witness for ourselves. That's what I like to get to. How can we actually experience this and make it our own and then be able to work with it? Otherwise, we're just memorizing things. You know, I've memorized a lot of lists. I used to be very proud of how many things I memorized. But how much help was that? Actually, it's probably some help, but, you know, it certainly doesn't hold a candle to experience. So the sheets that are in the back that I want you to fill out at lunchtime have two questions. When did you notice that self-identity was absent? In other words, you were in for a period of time, long or short, not obsessed with self. Every one of you has had that experience. You forget it. You put no credence to it. This is not being mindful. When we start putting credence into those experiences, they start multiplying. This is why we go on retreats, why I suggest everybody once a week spend a day in silence, turn everything off, start noticing real life. So that's the first question, and you might have to think back, when was that? When was that? I asked this in prison the other night, and I love giving this talk on self-identity in prison, because they are obsessed with self-identity. They insist this is how they survive. And as I've asked, how's that working for you? And I'll go into one young man in a little bit, and about how it was working for him. The second question is, when did you notice that self-identity was causing suffering? You were obsessed with self. Now this one's much easier. I think all of us can come up with an answer for this quite quickly. So, you know, just find an example when that constricted self that wanted it your way suffered. And I also want to emphasize before we begin, I'm not talking about dealing with trauma. That is a completely different topic. I'm talking about everyday experience, our everyday lives, the suffering that we cause ourselves and others in our everyday lives. Trauma is a whole other topic, and some of the suggestions and things I will be talking about, especially this afternoon, are not appropriate for people who are dealing with trauma. With that said, I am also going to mention, I work with a traumatized population, people who have spent 20 years in solitary confinement. And this practice and this looking at self-identity has been a huge benefit for many of them. Not everybody. A lot of people are just resistant. Don't even want to look at that. It's too painful. So self-identity takes two forms. The exterior identity that we present to the world, which is called our persona, and then the interior self-identity, which we try very, very hard, for the most part, to keep hidden from everyone. Not always. Sometimes they coincide. I was thinking about this, and I thought of a couple examples, but I'd like to know, have you ever noticed when those two identities have coincided? Anybody? When have the two identities, the exterior and the interior, the persona and the interior self-identity. So we keep the interior mostly hidden, don't talk about it, and our exterior, this is what I want to present to the world. But sometimes they come together. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, thank you. So safety, when you're safe, yeah.
Did you see the same as Carl Rogers' congruency?
I'm not a psychologist or a therapist.
When you're congruent.
Okay.
I'm asking, would you say it's a congruent
state? I guess so, yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah. When they come together, yeah. Exactly. Yep. I think that's another good example. Safety, joy. Also, I thought shame. It's like almost these extremes. You know, when we're joyful and happy for someone, you know, interior, we just most of the time feel really good, unless we're jealous or something. But the same goes with if we've been shamed. You know, our persona has been disrupted, and our interior feels it as well. Yeah. That's a good question. What do you think? What do you think? Pardon me? You know, I think, and maybe someone else has a thought about this, for our exterior persona, I think that's probably true. I think interior, we all suffer from the same malady of, what am I doing? What's going on with me? Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And that's another good example of like an extreme emotion that's going to show on the outside. And you feel it on the inside as well. The two are congruent, which I just learned a new word today.
I think sometimes when we're with have them to come together.
Yeah, yeah. I think you're absolutely right. And be happy and joyful and almost take on a childlike aspect yourself. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, those are good examples. Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And ultimately, what we want to do, our goal should be there should be no difference. I think this is probably an awakened person, where what you see on the outside is exactly what's going on the inside. And some of us might know a friend or a relative or a teacher or somebody that seems to have that. And you want to be around that person. There's no mystery. What is there is what is there. And it's comforting. Regarding the persona, V.S. Ramachandran apparently thought we were very, very obsessed with our persona when he defined it as, it may not be coincidental that you use phrases like self-conscious when you really mean that you are conscious of others being conscious of you. And that really, I think that sums it up very nicely. It is your persona, it's how you want people to see you. Of course, a lot of this comes from your interior, maybe all of it comes from interior, your interior self, but how you want the world to see you, how you have been defining yourself. And the bad part is you don't have full control over that. You have some, but not full control. And the example I've always given is the aging process. In our society, aging is bad. Don't age. Hide it. Don't tell your age. Get surgery. Do something, but don't do that. This is beyond your control. And how much suffering, I just had dinner with a couple Sangha friends the other night, and we were talking about aging, and especially, well, maybe men too, with women, it's not polite to ask their age. That's getting too much into an exterior persona that they were trying to represent, that you're diluting. Not good. But what a relief it is when you finally just get over that. Wow. Don't have to pretend I'm 21 anymore. No more surgery. No, not for me. I've never had surgery. But you get what I'm talking about. So your persona is often not within your control, and we suffer due to that. And also your persona, just like the interior self that you notice when you're meditating. Remember when I asked you, what is going on right this minute? Can you notice what is taking place in your mind? I bet half of you couldn't. It's a fuzzball. It's just going like this. And that's okay if you notice that. That's mindfulness. Because the more you start noticing, it starts slowing down. And you can start making sense of it. But you have to pay attention. If you constantly just go off into whatever thought trip you're on, you're never going to come back and be mindful. It's always monitoring, looking. What am I doing now? What's going on now? Until eventually it starts to slow down and you realize you don't have to work so hard. It's a natural process of just quieting. It's a relief. So your persona is constantly changing as well. You know, as you age, as you change professions, as you're not a student, you're a worker, you're a this, you're an aunt, you're an uncle, you're a parent, you're a landlord, you're a renter. You know, it goes on, and you have to constantly, in the society, keep changing the persona according to where you are. It can be very stressful. This goes back again to, wouldn't it be great to be able to combine the interior and the exterior and not have to work so hard on what it is to be in the world? There's also, with personas, those unwanted emotions that sometimes erupt for apparently no reason. We have so much beneath the surface that we have no control over. And this came up for me when I was giving a talk, and I don't think it was on this, but something triggered one of the inmates, and he started crying. You don't do this in prison, especially in a maximum security prison. You just don't do it. But he started crying and tried to hide it. But whatever was deep beneath the surface and whatever word came out that triggered it, his persona was in danger. And this happens to us too. Have you ever just been someplace and all of a sudden this surge of emotion comes up for maybe apparently no reason, but all of a sudden you're not that persona, you're fragile. Wouldn't it be great to be authentic and to allow that to happen? Well, we can start doing that. This is, I think, also one of the reasons we have safety in Sangha. It's a place where that can happen and not be afraid. Like Jana had mentioned, safety. That is so hugely important. So, the other thing is, and I think this is another interesting aspect of persona, I got to watch my time because I go off and I ramble. When do I need to quit? Oh, I still have time. If you're in touch with your deepest values, you will know how to say and act in any situation. So in Buddhist parlance, it's adhering, practicing, training with the five precepts, you know, in difficult situations. Does everybody know the five training precepts? All right. They are. I will train in not killing or harming living beings. I will train in taking only what is freely given. I will train in avoiding sexual misconduct. I will train in speaking truthfully. I will train in refraining from taking intoxicants that lead to heedlessness. So this is, you know, for your outer persona, a guide, what to do in a particular situation. I think a good example right now is Jeff Bezos, who, you know, was being blackmailed because of sexual improprieties, the third precept he shouldn't have broken. But instead of letting his outer persona take over, I'm Jeff Bezos and I'm wealthy and I run half the world and I must be seen this way, he admitted, yes, sexual impropriety and naked pictures of him, and he's not going to let the Inquirer get away with it. He's reporting it. That's really letting down a persona. I give him a whole lot of credit for doing that. That's abiding by some virtuous conduct. Sam Harris, who wrote this book, which I encourage all of you to get and read, it is a wonderful tome on science and philosophy, and you're shaking your head, you've read it, spirituality, and pardon me, the title is Waking Up. And Sam Harris is interesting because he's an atheist. He's done many talks on being an atheist. Yet, he's done over 3 years of intense Buddhist retreats. But he says there's no problem with that. He said Buddhism is as close to getting into the science of the mind, and he's a PhD in neurology. He said, this is as close as you're going to get to actually how to work with the mind and the brain. which is why I now read it twice, because I think it's so interesting. Anyway, he also talks about virtuous conduct in terms of a persona, and he made the statement a couple of, actually I don't know how many years ago, but apparently a while ago, that he will never lie again. How interesting. He will never lie again. As I said Thursday night a few Thursdays ago, actually this isn't the Buddhist teachings, but he's not a Buddhist, so he doesn't care. You know, lying is takes into factors of, is it timely, is it kind, is it said with an open heart, is it true? You know, you consider all these things. But he said, no, he's just never lying again. And he said, and I let everyone know it. And so whatever I say is never meant to hurt anyone, it's just the truth. So if you don't really want to know how you look today, don't ask me, because I will tell you. So now you know. So the question about your persona is it causing you or anyone else harm? That's your question. Is what you are doing causing yourself or anyone else harm? You have to have a persona. But it can be the best persona you can possibly make it by looking at it in terms of virtuous conduct, and is it causing harm? The very first precept, harming or killing living beings. And eventually, I believe, as you start looking at your persona this way, you start becoming genuine and not manipulative. I believe that happens. Sure. But you can Google five Buddhist five training precepts, but they are, I will train in not killing or harming living beings. Mm-hmm. I will train in not taking what is free, taking only what is freely given, essentially not stealing. I will train in abstaining from sexual misconduct. I will train in speaking truthfully. And I will train in avoiding intoxicants that lead to heedlessness. That last one, briefly, was the last one to be added onto the precepts because of an incident that happened in the Buddha's time, but contemporary teachers have taught if you break that last one, you will break all the rest. So it was added on much later. I gave a talk on the persona and outer self in prison to a group. And there was one young man there, no, well, I guess not so young, 36 or so, and talking about persona and self-identity. And he's a Hispanic gang member. And I spoke about it, and he and another inmate got really, really, really irate about, are you telling us to drop our identities? Do you know how dangerous it would be in here if we did that? And I can get bossy, and I'm told that. And I said, okay, so your family no longer wants anything to do with you. Your victim's family wants nothing to do with you. You're constantly looking out to see who is going to kill you from the other gang. You're in prison, for God's sake. How has this identity been helpful to you? And he got really, really pissed and walked out and never came back again. And his friend there also got mad at me and said, you shouldn't be talking like that. The guy who left later found out, went to staff and gave up his gang identity and went into protective custody. And then they transferred him out of the prison. They transferred him to San Quentin. And some of you in Yana might remember this guy. And he's now released. He got out way early because he finally gave up that identity. And I understand he's reconciled with his family. He never spoke to me again. But I'm just glad that took place, finally. And that's an extreme of self-identity, but this is why I love, and those of you who go into prison love it, because you can really see these principles at work because it's extreme. Yeah? Exactly. But that's another self-identity.
Yeah.
You know, we have to do this because this is what we do. Yeah, well, I'm for the sake of discussion, I'm talking about Buddhist values. You know, as you know, in prison, there's all different kinds of values, which, no thank you. Yeah.
Your example of Jeff Bezos is really good. On the question of speaking truthfully, I'm reminded of the President of the United States, Donald Trump, and I don't know if that came up for other people here, but this is one of the things, if you watch MSNBC or CNN at night, this is all they're saying.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. But we won't go into politics.
No.
I agree with you, yes.
And even if you don't agree with me, that politics is bad.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you, Jim. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's the outer self. Inner self. When you begin to examine your persona, it makes it a little bit easier to start examining the inner you. And I know with my own self, I really started examining what was I doing and the suffering I was causing myself after going to Burma, where Joseph Goldstein was the teacher. And I've told this story many times, but some of you haven't heard it. And I had told him that Joseph Goldstein is a well-known Buddhist teacher. Actually, in Sam Harris's podcast, I just heard Joseph Goldstein being interviewed. He's been interviewed twice, and Sam Harris has apparently known him for 25 years. But I'm not a Buddhist. But anyway. On this retreat, I told him about just a little problem I was having that I'll share with you. I said I'd really like to start going to Zen services, because there's aspects of Zen I find very appealing. I said, but I don't want to because I don't know all the ritual. And I know you're supposed to walk in on your left foot and you turn around three times and bow to somebody and then you do this and you do that. And I said, I'll look like a fool going in there. And he said, so that's what you're afraid of, looking like a fool. And I said, yes. And he said, then that's your practice. Go be a fool. And it was one of the best pieces of advice that somebody could have given. You know, this outer persona was causing so much suffering. Oh, okay, just be a fool. So I've been going to Zen services, and I still don't get it and don't do it right, but it doesn't really matter. I enjoy myself, especially one Zen priest who speaks here on the fourth Monday of each month, Mio. Did you go?
No.
No. He's very good, and he's very simple, and he's very plain, and just says, I'm not the answer man. And I thought, yes, a teacher that says, I'm not the answer man. That's wonderful. So Sam Harris brings up a very interesting thing in this book about finding your inner identity. Where is it? Where exactly is this self-identity that you keep hidden? In your heart? You think so?
In your mind?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think it's in my ego. which is the same as my self-identity. But yeah, deep down, I mean, it's just been building up for my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
And now I have this identity. I think I'm chipping away at it. I'm probably adding on.
It's an interesting question, and actually I'm going to talk a little bit about that. Well, Sam Harris goes, is it behind your eyes? You know, is it this thing back here, that's watching out, is that your inner identity? Or is it your body? You know, your whole body? And if it's your body, is it your skin? Is skin identity? Or maybe it's your skeleton. Maybe that should be your identity. What is it? Or maybe it's your thoughts. Maybe your thoughts are your identity, but they keep changing so much. And here's an interesting analogy he gave. You know, you walk around downtown and you see somebody walking around talking to themselves, you know, having this really rampant conversation with themselves, and you're thinking, that person's crazy. If anybody looked inside your head and saw what you were doing, you're doing exactly the same thing. They're just doing it out loud. So is that your self-identity? This crazy mishmash of stuff that's going on? Is it the brain? Is it the brain itself? And this is what gets really interesting with him. He talks about the split brain theory. Now, we all have two hemispheres of our brains, and those of you who have medical backgrounds could explain this way better, so this is going to be a very general summation of what he said. Yeah, we have two brains, two hemispheres of the brain, and they are connected by this, I forget the name of it, but they are connected. And sometimes if somebody has severe cases of epilepsy, they cut that connection and it ceases the episodes. I don't know why, but it does. But the interesting thing that they found out was when they cut this, you have two thinking brains, and sometimes they even argue with each other and they have two different personalities. And he offers evidence of this and what takes place. And he said sometimes they don't even get along. They argue. One side of the brain will say, I'm going to do this, and the other one, when it's cut, no way, we're not doing that. And it causes another set of problems. So is it your brain? And if it's your brain, which side of your brain? And then if you decide it's the left side, which part of the left side? The part that speaks, the part that, you know, whatever. So, and then other people talk about, in prison they say this all the time, where it's my soul. It's my soul. And, you know, as a Buddhist practitioner, we don't believe in a permanent anything, anicca, impermanence. Anatta, no permanent self. So it doesn't make sense to have a soul. And even if you believe in souls, how is that helping you with this whole self-identity thing? I was writing about this morning. What if you have it's determined you have a good soul, then you don't have to do anything. You can just keep doing what you're doing because your soul's good, if it's permanent. Or worse, what if you have a bad soul and you're going to hell and there's nothing you can do to change it? That's kind of depressing. I think I'd rather believe in impermanence. I think it's way better. Impermanence with causes and conditions rolling on. So what is this inner self, the self-identity? It is a process. It's an ongoing process that is constantly changing. And the more we can grasp this, instead of thinking there's a solid permanent self, the more freedom we have. thinking that we are a static, ongoing, concrete person is the cause of our suffering. And the reason is it's not there. And by constantly looking for it, you're going to be unhappy. You know, we have what's called Kalyanamitta, spiritual friends. This is a hugely important thing in Buddhist practice. And being intimate with somebody with a Kalyanamitta means sharing the frustration and sharing your discovery about this ongoing process and admitting what's going on. Like the inmate who I told you who cried. He later said that was the one place he felt safe to do that. He couldn't do it out in the yard. In our group, this is in the Sangha, it's the one place where you can vocalize concerns, perplexities, what you have learned about yourself. You have to do it someplace if you really want to start seeing this ongoing process. Okay, so we're going to do a very brief exercise. And this, again, comes from Sam Harris, and it's called Looking Without a Head. And what I want you to do is wander around somewhere in the building or look out the window. It'll take 5 minutes. And I want you to find something to look at without your head. Don't think about it. You don't have a head. Just see it. This doesn't work for everyone. I found it worked for me, and I just finished a month-long solo retreat, and this was a wonderful exercise. I'm not going to ask you how it went, because like I said, it will work for some people and not for others. But try to look at whatever you decide to look at, what is your focus, without your head. Seeing without a head. Okay? 5 minutes. Go find something that you're going to look at and come back.
Do you mind if I move the daffodils to a different room? I'm a virgin.
Oh. Okay, I'll take care of it.
Okay.
Okay, so I am curious if anybody got this. Did it work at all for anybody?
I can comment.
Okay.
I looked at two things, and the first one was a picture outside, and I just couldn't help but put a story to the picture. And then I looked at a plant in the kitchen, and it generated feelings instead of a story. Mm-hmm. I think I was getting close to what you wanted us to do. I'm not sure.
Thank you. Anybody else?
I can comment over here.
Yeah.
When you were even saying it, I kind of did it. It's kind of a heavy thing, so I won't turn it off a heavy thing. But I thought if I looked at it, kind of like you were saying, it felt detached, and it felt like I was a silent observer, and I actually even laughed to myself. So this thing that seemed so heavy, but if I was just, you know, anyways, it felt detached by doing it.
Great, thank you. Anybody else? Yeah, back there.
I love the sound of bowls, and it took me 7 years to find the bowl with the right music. I'm very particular about the tone. Every time I see what I need to make it sound. And so I was looking at the bowl, and I let go of all of my desire to make it sound.
Sorry. All right. Anybody else? Yeah.
I have to say that when you first said that, I had a little anger, a little angst, because I thought, I have no idea what you're talking about. And then I realized, that's my persona coming into play. And one of my personal mantras is, what you think of me is none of my business. So I brought that up.
Good for you. Thank you. All right, yes.
I was looking at that runner on the table there, and at first, like other people have mentioned, I started thinking about the material, where it came from, all of that I was making the story up. And then I tried to let that go and just look at the color, and I started feeling the color.
Oh. That's wonderful. Thank you very much. Yeah, it's an interesting exercise. And Sam Harris says, you get it or you don't get it. Or it might start to happen or it might not. It's really just another way of being mindful. You know, he's just giving the clue of drop your head. Drop all the stories. Can you just see what's happening? And yeah.
My experience with it has been, because I love the book as well, and when I first read it, I got super frustrated because I was really trying to and it wasn't until I was on a long retreat way after, when I was completely not thinking about it, that it actually clicked in. It's one of those things where I feel like you can't really force it to.
Just like you said at the beginning when we were talking about goals. As soon as you, I want that, I want that, I want that, you can guarantee that is never going to happen. But as soon as you drop in and are just present, it happens, yeah.
But I feel like still having that, because the idea was in my system prior, might have contributed to it, so it's still valued to be conceptual.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, As you remember in the book, he talks about all of his years of meditation and then finally going to a Dogen master and getting it. And he said, boy, I realized I didn't have to put all that work in. But if he hadn't put all that work in, he wouldn't have gotten it.
Yeah.
So I was actually surprised he even said that, because it seemed obvious to me. Anyway, all right. One last thing, and then we're going to, what are we doing? I'm going to lead you in a little guided meditation before lunch. This was a statement I read, and I thought this is really good. It's something to think about. Being wisely selfish and being selfless amount to the same thing. Being wisely selfish and selfless amount to the same thing. Does anybody get that? It's not a con. It really is real. And here again, I hate to harp on prison practice, but I've learned so much from it. I went into prison originally for selfish reasons. I went in because I was suffering because of my own son's addiction and incarceration. And I went in because I wanted to see people worse off than me. That was my selfish reason. It became selfless when I started losing myself in prison and being concerned about others. So it started out wisely selfish, and it turned out it's such a relief to be in a place where the self is no longer dictating everything. It's concern for others. So that's my own. Anybody else have their own interpretation of being wisely selfish and being selfless amount to the same thing? Yeah.
Climate change. I'm a scientist, and for the longest time, I wanted to know everything about climate change. I knew everything. I studied it for years. Now, it doesn't matter. I'm just acting as a volunteer trying to do something about it. And yeah. I don't care about the science. And I see the scientists in my group. They're wonderful people. They're phenomenal people. They're only interested in the science. And getting them to say anything about doing something about it is like pulling teeth.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Jim. Anybody else have anything on that? It's kind of a profound statement. I think something you contemplate. So I think there's a whole lot of truth in it. It's almost like the Zen koan about only as you get to know yourself can you drop yourself. You know, if you don't know what it is that's causing suffering, you're never going to relinquish it. Yeah.
Very mundane.
Mm-hmm.
I selfishly do that, but in the process, I'm being present with them,
yes.
Not with myself.
Yes. Yep. Great example. Thank you. Can you repeat that for back here?
It was when we spend time with our grandkids, we do it because we love them, and if there's a selfish reason for doing that, but in the process, we forget ourselves.
Thank you for sharing that. Somebody found this in the bathroom. Is it somebody's phone? Amy, come on down. It's right here. All right. And then, and this is kind of off topic a little bit, but I'm just curious about your response, because I just spoke to somebody who is going through chaplaincy training, and I'm mentoring them, and they just had the exercise that I remember so well in chaplaincy, where you sit with someone and look at each other's eyes for 5 minutes. It's excruciating. Why is it excruciating? What is it about that that makes it...
Well, I think we're uncomfortable in silence. Are you silently looking?
Oh, yeah, but Buddhists are not uncomfortable silence. Yeah, no. But thank you.
Well, you were very congruent.
Boy, I am going to be using that word a lot. Yes.
Together, but I get to do that and not have some sort of profound emotion.
Right, right. Thank you. Thank you. Yes?
It seems to me that that practice or the practice that has been creating conflict, because at the time you're looking into a person's eyes, you're probably subconsciously creating stories, but at the same time, considering your eyes are linked to your soul, you're playing a little defense, and you're trying to project the proper response.
I think that's a good response. Yeah, yeah. Anybody else? Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Yes.
I think it may be that something seems like it's going to go down because it's a very intimate thing. I'm staring at someone's eyes. The window to the soul, like you said, that it can be very intimate being that aware of someone's soul.
Thank you. Yeah, Vicki.
There was a time in my life where I was doing very intensive personal growth work, and part of the, and there were like retreats we went to, and that exercise of sitting across from someone, I mean, we did that for not 5 minutes, some torturous amount, but the result, it was really about creating intimacy and actually losing yourself by seeing yourself. It's a very interesting, I don't even know how to explain that process, why it happens that way. The reflection of seeing yourself in someone else's eyes, it's uncomfortable, but it's also very, freeing about projection and who you think the person is and who you think you are.
Yeah.
I don't even know what to say about it. It's very different.
Well, I know in prison, Jacques Verdun is my mentor when I first started out, and he suggested you have each prisoner look at each other in the eye, you know, not staring, but, you know, introduce themselves and look at each other fully in the face and see each other. And I think it's made a huge difference by them having to look at each other, regardless of race, gang affiliation, whatever. And I always say, see an individual person in each space. And I don't know, hopefully it helps. All right, what we're going to do now, unless somebody has any more comments on this first part, like I said, the second part, we're going to talk about ways to start detaching so much from self-identity that causes us suffering and problems, different strategies. But I'm going to do a little guided meditation before lunch. We're going to eat at noon, and it's going to be in silence. And I'll do some mindful eating instruction right before lunch. Okay, so once again, get in a comfortable sitting position.